You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of June 2013 on Monaco 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monaco 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Clemency Burton-Hill and Poppy Trowbridge.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's agenda with Fiona Wilson, our Tokyo bureau chief. Fiona, what have you got for us today?
Well, North Korea's call for talks with the US has met with a chilly response. Shinzo Abe, the Japanese Prime Minister, is in Belfast for the G8 talks, which look like they'll be dominated by Syria. And finally, there's been a very strong response in China to an attack on Chinese students in Bordeaux.
We're looking forward to hearing about all of those. Then we'll also be in Istanbul to hear who's managing to make themselves heard in the battle for the city. And in a sea of statistics about how best to live our lives, a new book attempts to clarify the risks and benefits of our life decisions.
A burger or a sausage or something like that, on average, if you have that as a daily diet, it's equivalent to every sort of bacon sandwich or burger thing, taking about half an hour of your life. You know, it takes about a year of your life altogether of your adult life.
Plus, the Monaco Culture team bring us a report from Palestine on their latest singing sensation.
He is one of the most popular singer nowadays, you know. Their feeling or their perception about him, that he's one of the most amazing singer, you know, in Palestine and in the whole of the Arabic world.
All that, and we'll play some of our own music too. It's all to come here on the next hour on Midori House.
But let's start with the world news headlines and David Spencer.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. US President Barack Obama will meet Russia's Vladimir Putin later today to discuss Syria ahead of the G8 summit in Northern Ireland. It's their first private meeting in a year and comes after Mr. Obama angered the Kremlin by authorizing US military support for some of the Syrian opposition. During talks with British Prime Minister David Cameron in London on Sunday, Mr. Putin was fierce in his criticism of the West position. He asked whether the US wanted to arm rebel fighters that, in his words, eat human flesh, and questioned US evidence that government forces in Syria had used chemical weapons. In the United States, the former Alaska governor and Republican vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin has caused controversy after weighing into the Syria debate. She said Washington should stop interfering overseas.
We're talking now more new interventions in these radical Islamic countries that aren't even respecting basic human rights, with both sides, they're slaughtering each other as they scream over an arbitrary red line, Allah Akbar, I say, until we have someone who knows what they're doing, I say, let Allah sort it out.
The two-day G8 summit is expected to be dominated by Syria, but the global economy will also be a focus. British Prime Minister David Cameron wants discussions on tax transparency, with the amount of tax paid by large corporations a recent talking point. The likes of Google, Apple and Amazon have been accused of not paying their fair share. There have been further clashes between anti-government protesters and police across Turkey. There were confrontations in the capital Ankara and in Istanbul, where riot police fired tear gas in the streets around Taksim Square. Two Turkish unions are staging a one-day nationwide strike today in protest over what they feel are unnecessarily forceful tactics by police. Thousands of protesters have demanded the resignation of Bulgaria's new socialist-led government. The protests have continued over the weekend, despite the two-week-old government bowing to public anger on Saturday and promising to reverse its appointment of a powerful media figure and coalition ally to lead state security. Around 15,000 protesters poured onto the streets of the capital Sofia on Sunday, many demanding changes in the electoral law to give new, smaller parties a chance of winning seats in parliament. The Israeli president Shimon Peres says the election of Hassan Rouhani as the new Iranian president could bring an improvement to the country's policy on nuclear activity. Widely hailed as a moderate, the former nuclear negotiator swept the elections in a landslide victory on Saturday. Mr. Peres welcomed what he called Rouhani's surprise victory and said it showed the hidden strength of the people.
I'm not sure that he specified what will be his policies, but it will be better, I am sure. And that is the reason why the people voted for him. And it surprised all the experts and all the prophets. And that is really intriguing me. And the carriers of this hidden strength are the people.
The US State Department is expected to announce the appointment of Washington lawyer Cliff Sloan to oversee the closure of the controversial Guantanamo detention camp today. President Obama has long promised to close down the site, which was set up by the previous Bush administration to house suspected terrorists. More than 100 of the 166 prisoners in the camp have joined a hunger strike to protest the failure to resolve their fate after more than a decade of detention. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, David. It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
This is Midori House, live from Studio One in London. The time is 15:06 in Hong Kong, 10:06 in Izmir, and 8:06 here in London.
We start the show today with our daily agenda setter, three stories to be following for the next 24 hours. And setting the agenda for us today is Fiona Wilson, our Tokyo Bureau Chief. Good morning, Fiona. Where shall we start?
Good morning, good afternoon here. Well, I think one of the big stories here is North Korea. It's always a big story here, and the ongoing situation there. And they, out of the blue, suggested talks with the US yesterday. They wanted to have talks, they said, on, you know, on a broad range of things, including a peace treaty between North and South Korea after the end of the Korean War. So these are very broad-ranging talks. And, you know, it came just after the collapse, or they didn't even start the talks between North and South that were scheduled for last week, which didn't happen. There was a disagreement about the level of the delegation. So, you know, the US has actually reacted rather coolly, I would say, and they said they want actions, not words.
Do you think that they would set the bar quite high if they were to go into talks?
I think that one of the big problems is that the US has already said that North Korea's nuclear ambitions has to be on the table at any negotiations. And in turn, North Korea has said it doesn't want to talk about that. As long as it's you know, the opposite side has nuclear weapons, it doesn't want to talk about its own ambitions, its own program. So this is a real sticking point. And until that comes onto the table, I just don't see where the talks are going to happen.
Fiona, what's been the reaction from the US? Has there
been? You know, yeah, there has been, absolutely. Yeah, of course, it's a big thing for North Korea to reach out to the States. It follows a certain pattern. There's been a level of tension. It's been increasing, and this is the pattern over the last few years. Then North Korea starts to talk about negotiation. We've been through all this before, and the National Security Council spokeswoman has said that yes, the US wants credible negotiations, but it wants to see concrete steps by North Korea as well, and by that they mean at least talks about denuclearization.
Incredible being the optimum word there. Now, meanwhile, South Korea presumably talking to China. Where does that leave things if the North is sort of reaching out to the US and the South is reaching out to China in terms of the wider geopolitical implications of where we're at?
Yeah, it's a very complicated game, isn't it? I mean, no doubt the fact that South Korea is talking to China at the end of this month is playing its part. You know, North Korea does not want to be left out. There's some speculation that maybe it's showing China, look, we can offer dialogue. We will make, you know, a positive step. There's a suggestion that China is fed up with North Korea. But seriously, it's very difficult for anyone to actually know what is going on at the top level of North Korean policy. So, in fact, we're all guessing. There are many interpretations. But I think, you know, also China has just met, you know, Xi Jinping has just met with Obama. That's also going to be playing its part. North Korea is being left out. And later this week, we've got talks on the sixth party talks with the US, Japan and South Korea. That's also coming up. So I think North Korea is feeling a bit like, well, hang on, what about us? We want to get in on this act as well.
Fiona, let's move on. You mentioned Japan there. The next story you're looking at is about Japan and its reaction to what's going on in County Fermanagh, Northern Ireland here, the G8 summit?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, I think, you know, Japan is there. Shinzo Abe is there. I think he was hoping he'd be talking about central banks, economic stimulus, Abenomics, his favourite topic. And it really looks like Syria is going to be the dominant agenda on this particular weekend of talks. And I think the same goes for the UK, is maybe hoping that tax evasion would be a big issue. But it looks like, again, it's Syria all over. So I think Japan's really wanting to get across its anti-austerity policies. It wants to show that they're working. It's come at a rather unfortunate time because actually things are not looking quite so positive for Abenomics over the last couple of weeks.
Just give us the context of Abenomics. Explain exactly how it works.
Well, I mean, just basically, it's a very, very simply, the idea was to just pump an awful lot of money and have a massive stimulus policy, fiscal stimulus, monetary easing. And really, the main thing was to get the economy growing. Japan, as everybody knows, has had this very stagnant economy. Wages have been stagnant. There's been no growth. And the point of Abenomics was to stimulate this. Now, it was all going very, it was going swimmingly, but suddenly the Nikkei has been very volatile. The yen has been strengthening again. So it's very unclear at the moment exactly which direction Abenomics is heading in. So it may not be that the perfect moment for Shinzo Abe to head off to Northern Ireland and showcase his policy.
No, but he would have likely hoped for a bit of endorsement that it was the right direction in which to take economic policy in Japan in order to get through those blips that you were describing there, the Nikkei dipping and such. The likelihood of economic development, the continuing crisis, what to do about it here in Europe, as well as how it affects other countries around the world, like you said, will slip down the agenda. But Cameron seems determined to focus on tax here. Do you think Syria will just wipe everything else off the agenda? Because earlier today we talked through this a little bit, and there didn't seem to be anything that could come out of this on Syria that's concrete.
No, but I think, you know, in terms of the media agenda, you only need to look at today. I mean, what Putin said yesterday about Assad's enemies, you know, he called them cannibals. Now, that has stolen all the headlines. Tax evasion doesn't really look that sexy, does it, in comparison? So I think it's going to be difficult there. I mean, clearly Putin is out on a limb. He's on his own at the G8 with his view of what's going on in Syria. Japan is actually pretty quiet about what's going on in Syria. It's not really there to get involved in that, and it doesn't want to get involved in that, I'm quite sure. So it's at the moment, it's quite unclear exactly how central a role Shinzo Abe will be playing in the G8.
Let's move on to the outrage felt by Chinese people after this assault on students in France. Tell us more.
Well, this is a curious story. On Friday, six Chinese wine students in Bordeaux, they're studying wine, you know, in an area obviously absolutely full of vineyards. And they were attacked really rather brutally by three very drunk French men who've all been detained. It's caused absolute uproar. You just need to look at the Chinese newspapers. It's right at the top. I mean, it's usually, on most papers, it's the second story after a very big announcement of new policies between Taiwan and China. So it's really dominant. It's the context of this is that China is getting very involved in the French wine business. Nobody has actually made the direct link, but there is certainly a context to this that Chinese buyers have been snapping up a lot of vineyards in Bordeaux. And this may have contributed. Who knows? Nobody's asked these men yet.
They haven't explained their rationale, but the idea is that this growing resentment that the truly French market of Bordeaux wine is being taken over. Is that really the gist of it?
Well, I think that's a sort of suggestion. It's hard to know. I mean, it could equally be three people who got very drunk. They were apparently, you know, hurling racist abuse. So, and French politicians have been coming out very strongly talking about xenophobia, how it's damaged France's reputation. They've come in very quickly to try and, I suppose, you know, limit the damage, because it really makes France look absolutely terrible. And François Hollande has just been in China and rather unfortunately had been, you know, trumpeting that it was safe for Chinese people in France. So it was a rather unfortunate timing. And, you know, the fact that Chinese buyers are snapping up these vineyards is a context. It doesn't necessarily explain this specific incident, but it also came just as a huge wine expo was starting in the region yesterday, and it goes on for this week. So I think it's rather cast a shadow over that event, which is the biggest event for the wine business in France.
It certainly sounds like it has. Thank you, Fiona, very much for joining us today. Fiona Wilson there.
Coming up on Midori House, what now for the two sides of Turkey's Taksim Square standoff?
The menu brings you the culinary stories and tales that are sure to inspire. From cake, steak and tapas to oysters, chicken and caviar, the menu roams the world in search of the best things to eat and the best places to eat them in. We uncover the trends that are taking hold and interview those spearheading a gastronomic movement.
The spirit in there represents the legacy of everything where we have been involved in the rum-making business. You have to taste it to believe it.
Okay, can we take Peruvian food back to London? Different type of corns, you know, a different type of cheese. And I knew at that stage, yeah, this is good.
So if you don't know the difference between a Salzburg knockel and Kolonskink, a head cheese and a falooda, tune into the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time. I hope you're hungry.
That's the menu, in association with Krug.
Welcome back. The time is 10:16 in Istanbul. That makes it 8:16 here in London. And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Poppy Trowbridge, and Clemency Burton-Hill.
We turn our sights now to Istanbul. Over the weekend, Turkish authorities have upped the ante in their crackdown on the protest movement in Taksim Square. The escalating tension played out in further street clashes and hundreds of people being detained yesterday, including some of the doctors and nurses who've been treating protesters.
The past 3 days have seen the worst violence of the uprising, but Turkey's divisions have been laid bare over the past 3 weeks. Prime Minister Recep Erdogan rallied hundreds of thousands of his own supporters yesterday. But now unions want a nationwide strike today. Well, with tensions so high, what happens next is crucial. Joining us now on the line is Monocle's Istanbul correspondent, Caleb Lauer, who has been in the midst of all this there this weekend. Welcome to you, Caleb.
Oh, thanks very much.
How was yesterday? It seemed to be the height of the recent tensions. Many people detained. What did you see?
Well, what was interesting about yesterday was the contrast between Erdogan's speech that he gave in Istanbul, which started at about 6 p.m. here, local time, and ended close to 8 o'clock. And while he was speaking, the confrontation with police was continuing across the city and across the country. There was a real stark contrast between the images that Erdogan was trying to portray, to promote. The rally itself was extremely well stage managed. The optics were incredible. They had almost 300,000 people in a square. The cameras were like something you would see at a Hollywood film set. But at the same time, you saw one of the biggest showings of resistance in the part of the city. There were clashes basically across the city. In the part where I live, there was almost 100,000 people walking down the motorway, which was stopped by police. And so the contrast couldn't have been more extreme yesterday. And Erdogan's speech was extremely sort of revealing in the type of narrative that he wants to impose on these events. The protesters are, in fact, terrorists. The people behind these protests are, in fact, international conspirators set to bring Turkey down. And the protesters themselves are very, very against Islamic values, this type of thing. It was a very, very scary day.
Caleb, among the hundreds who were detained yesterday included people who were actually helping the protesters, doctors and nurses. Presumably in the fight for hearts and minds, that's not going to play particularly well.
Well, that's one of the things that is most impressive in the negative sense about the last 2 days. Since the clearing of Gezi Park on Saturday night, you've seen the legal response starting. They've started to go after the lawyers that supported the protesters, detaining many of them. They've started detaining journalists at the scene, declaring that their press cards aren't valid. They've threatened the doctors and, as you said, the nurses that were providing volunteer services at Gezi Park during the events. So this type of thing, and also yesterday in Erdogan's speech, he made mention of the private businessmen and women that had offered support, the hotels, etc., that had sheltered protesters. So you're starting to see now the settling of accounts and through different channels. And this is one of the things that Erdogan has been very, very clear about doing. You know, he said that the people that spread messages on social media, we're coming after you. The people that are, you know, spreading lies, quote unquote, about Turkey, we're coming after you. So this is what we're starting to see. And the professional groups, like you say, the doctors and the nurses, the journalists, the lawyers, they are the first in the wave of this settling of accounts.
Caleb, I wonder about the focal point of this entire protest, the park itself, with all of these detentions and, as you said, Erdogan blaming more and more different groups of people. Has the whole thing spread out, or does that park still hold a very powerful centrifugal force?
The park is very, very important symbolically, and so is Taksim Square. They're adjacent to each other. Taksim Square is sort of the smaller counterpart. It's concrete, and then the Gezi Park, which is right behind it, is this much larger sort of green space. Symbolically, this is very, very important. I mean, what the protesters had achieved at Gezi Park for 10 days was quite remarkable. It was a basically self-governing commune where you had many, many different organizations coming together. And what people remember most, I mean, remember is sort of unfortunately the word that we have to use here because the park has been cleared. But what captured the sort of the imagination of people there so strongly was that you had groups that had never really sat down beside each other, had never really had any type of dialogue, coming together and showing their solidarity with each other. You speak with, for example, people like the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender groups there, the LGBT groups there. The first group that came out of their mouth was the anti-capitalist Muslims, who were their new best friends, basically. These groups, you know, had very little in common beforehand. You had Kurds sitting down with very, very nationalist Turks together, resisting police interventions. So this type of thing was very, very profound for the people that were there, and it will have a very, very profound effect on Turkish politics going forward. So the environmental aspect of Gezi Park is still important, but slightly diminished by the much more significant and profound solidarity that was developed there.
How lasting can that solidarity be, though, between, as you say, formerly disparate groups?
Well, one of the most negative themes of this whole thing is the theme of division, and you saw it starting to play out at the start of the week, where you had this intense expression of solidarity among people, but then slowly you started to see people working on these divisions. Are these protesters violent? Are they not violent? Are they marginal? Are they not marginal? Are they legal? Are they not legal? Are they patriotic or are they not patriotic? And this type of thing is being used by people to basically divide the movement. Now, that's the negative side. The other more sort of practical side of things is that, politics without debate, without disagreement, can't continue indefinitely, obviously. So whether or not you see a real sort of sense of uncritical solidarity continuing, I don't think that will be the case. But the significance of what was accomplished in terms of the emotional solidarity between groups and what they saw as possible will continue definitely.
Well, Caleb, I'm sure we'll be coming back to you again in upcoming days as we keep our focus on Istanbul. Thank you so much for joining us on Midori House this morning. Caleb Lauer, Monocle's correspondent in Istanbul.
The benefits of healthy eating, risks of smoking, dangers of a couple of hours in front of the telly, or any other life choice are often reduced to simple statistics, easily digested by Joe Public. A single alcoholic drink can add 30 minutes to your life, while an extra drink could cause the opposite effect, costing you that 30 minutes all over again.
Well, a new book endeavours to reclassify those measures of risk. The Norm Chronicles, Stories and Numbers About Danger, published by Profile Books, divides the risks into two clear categories, the micro-life and micro-mort. Co-author David Spiegelhalter spoke to our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who began by asking who exactly this Norm character is.
Well, Norm is this person we invented who tries to be rational about the risks in life, whether it's anxieties about your kids, about his health, about travelling anywhere, about his job. Norm is someone who tries to weigh things up and be sensible. Look at the numbers and look at the harms, look at the benefits. He's a bit like me, actually. I'm a statistician. I try to do this. But of course, it's hopeless because we're so governed by our emotions. And what we've done in the book, in order to sort of represent these alternatives of emotions, is to invent some other characters. One who's ridiculously cautious, called Prudence, who's you know, terribly anxious about everything, always wiping things before her children can touch them, and you know, she's covering her children in sun cream and she's worried about everything the whole time, everything she reads in the newspapers. And on the other end is this idiot called Kelvin, who's totally reckless, who just says, yeah, goes for it, thinks he's going to live forever, you know, takes every sort of risk in the book. So poor old Norm is trying to, you know, take this sort of sensible approach in the middle, and of course he struggles with it because we are, you know, governed by our emotions so much.
I wanted to ask David, I mean, if you read the papers or magazines like Men's Health, there's so many statistics and oh my god, you should be careful with that. If you eat pizza, you're gonna die.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Are we obsessed as a society with statistics like
I hope we are. It's my job. I'm a statistician. This is how I make my money. And I think actually we do quite like numbers, but to be honest, we're not well served by the media. You know, we just get numbers thrown at us, and we've got no idea of judging, you know, is this big, is this small, is this important? We don't care. I can make anything look big, I can make anything look small. You know, you tell me what you want and I'll tell the story that way. So we also are concerned about stories about numbers, but I suppose what we're trying to do is tell stories that are in a way balanced. They're not trying to manipulate you. There's this thing that psychologists talk about, which is rather nice, called misleading anecdote. You know, it's your auntie who's smoked 20 a day and lived till 100. It's the man who, you know, drinks carrot juice and his cancer clears up or something. These are anecdotes, stories that you read on the internet or something. They're not good. Or someone who has a pension but then wins a lot on the lottery. I mean, this is disastrous, really, as lessons of life. And so what we're interested in, I suppose, is if you can communicate numbers in a transparent, friendly way that doesn't overwhelm people, that doesn't try to baffle people, doesn't try to manipulate them, that they might be able to breed a little bit of immunity to misleading anecdote. That's an official phrase that psychologists use. Isn't that lovely? Immunity to misleading anecdote.
I would like you to explain the concept that you mentioned in the book about the micromort and the microlife.
Can you
tell us what it is and what is the difference between them?
There's two sorts of risks we face in our daily life. I cycled here, you know, and on a Boris bike, I cycled here. I could have been knocked off and run over in the Tottenham Court Road. I nearly was. Okay. Now, if I died then, that sort of risk is called is an acute risk. It's something I might end my life today. And we've got the unit we use for measuring that is a micromort, which is a 1 in a million chance of being killed by something. Okay. Now, also on the way here, I was breathing in. I don't know, has the air got worse in London? I was coughing and spluttering and everything like that. Now, that, the harm that's doing me by breathing in all this muck coming out of the cars is harming my health. Now, that's not going to kill me straight away, unless possibly. You know, unless I had asthma or something, you know, it's not going to kill me straight away, but it is damaging my health. So we've invented a unit for that sort of risk you take, which is a micro life, which is to do with chronic risks. Things that aren't going to, the risks we take by what we eat, what we drink, how much we exercise, all that kind of stuff that you read of in the newspapers.
So maybe, I mean, we can have like a very greasy cheeseburger and then go for a run for 3 hours.
Yeah, they just about cancel each other out. You don't have to run for 3 hours on the whole. You know, a burger or a sausage or something like that, on average, if you have that as a daily diet, it's equivalent to every sort of bacon sandwich or burger thing, taking about half an hour of your life. You know, it takes about a year of your life altogether of your adult life. So if you're going to eat that kind of diet every day, then it's equivalent to, you know, every time you eat this stuff, it's about half an hour of your life. On the other hand, if you get off your backside out of the sofa and actually do some moderate exercise, it's amazing the benefit. From the first 20 minutes exercise each day, it's equivalent really to getting about an hour extra on your life, an enormous return from just moving around, that first bit of exercise. Now, exercise, of course, it doesn't keep on like that, because otherwise you'd live forever. You can't keep on. You can't live forever. So actually, the next bit of exercise doesn't actually do you so much good. And after a while, it's not doing any good extra.
And I mean, reading your book, you did an impressive research. There's so many interesting statistics, like one in every 45 heart attacks are triggered by energetic sexual activity, for example. How did you get all of those information?
Well, I'm a medical statistician. You know, we read I hope every number we give is got a proper scientific basis. We try to get the best sources. We're using a lot of national statistics. We're using trying to use the best data we can. So although we tell the stories, and some of the stories read like the sort of thing you just read in some terrible magazine or just read, some internet site, we think that they're actually, pretty reliable, that the numbers do make sense. But of course, we try to tell the numbers in a fairly interesting way. So the micromort thing is quite nice because it enables you to compare these different activities you might want to do. So roughly speaking, every day we're exposed to about one micromort, one in a million chance of dying suddenly. That's how many people, 1 millionth of the population dies each day when they didn't expect to. They weren't ill, they just die from, they run over, they have, not a heart attack, that doesn't count, but they're murdered, or, only a couple are, but they fall off a ladder, et cetera, et cetera, have a car crash, blah, blah, blah. So one in a million. So it's a good unit. So we can compare it with a day's average risk. Now, the chance of getting actually killed by an asteroid, either by being hit by one or it landing in the Atlantic Ocean in a huge tsunami, sort of drowning Britain. Actually, the tsunami, they calculate, will be about, if one big one comes down in the Atlantic, it's going to be 200 meters high, the tsunami. Oh, imagine that. Anyway, it's probably not going to happen for a long time. And they reckon Americans have estimated one micromort per lifetime from a tsunami. So you can live a million lifetimes before you expect the asteroid to get you. 77 million years before the asteroid, which is about the time since the last big one came down and wiped out the dinosaurs. So, but if you go in for extreme sports, if you go scuba dive, it's about 5 micromorts, hang gliding is about 8, running a marathon is about 7, skydiving is about 7. They're all about the same, all about a week's worth for that sort of fairly popular extreme sport. If you're a base jumper, it's something different. You're really notching them up there.
To end our chat, David, I have a final question for you. What is the biggest risk, an all-body health scan or standing a mile and a half from the epicenter of the Hiroshima atom bomb?
Yeah, now this is the one we found really surprising when we looked at it, because they're the same radiation risk. If you could pay £1,000 and have a, they advertise them, have a whole body CT scan just to check that you're okay. £1,000. They don't tell you, it's the same radiation exposure as if you're standing a mile and a half from the Hiroshima bomb. And it probably won't do you any harm, but, for example, they've estimated that the CT scans that they carry out in the USA in 1 year will cause 29,000 cancers in the future.
Now I know my chances of being hit by an asteroid. That was co-author of the Norm Chronicles, Stories and Numbers About Danger, David Spiegelhalter, speaking to our researcher there, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. The time is 8:32 here in London, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Where over the next half hour, we'll welcome our Washington correspondent, Sasha Eisenberg, into the studio for a roundup of the US press. We'll review the Middle Eastern front pages with our Jerusalem correspondent, Joseph Dana, and we'll hear a report on Palestine's newest musical sensation from this week's culture show. But first, at the bottom of the hour, here's David Spencer with the news headlines.
Thank you very much indeed. Syria is set to dominate 2 days of talks at the G8 summit, which is beginning in Northern Ireland. British Prime Minister David Cameron will host the 39th summit of the Group of Eight, which will also focus on the global economy. Ahead of the summit, US President Barack Obama will meet the Russian President Vladimir Putin to discuss Syria. A nationwide strike has been called by leading unions in Turkey after continued violence between police and anti-government demonstrators. The unions are angry at what they call the over-aggressive tactics of the police. Protests have continued to mar the Confederations Cup in Brazil as riot police clash with demonstrators near the Maracanã Stadium. The activists were protesting against what they see as excessive use of public funds for stadiums and sporting events instead of health, education and public transport. The Ecuadorian Foreign Minister Ricardo Patino has met WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange at his country's London embassy. Assange has been granted political asylum by Ecuador, but will be arrested if he leaves the building. He's wanted for questioning over 2 sexual assault allegations in Sweden that he denies. South Korea has said that talks between North Korea and the United States will be almost impossible. Pyongyang has offered high-level talks with the US to ease tensions on the Korean Peninsula, but the White House said that any talks must involve the North taking action to show it's moving towards scrapping its nuclear weapons. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you, David. Now, a young Palestinian from the beleaguered Gaza Strip has become an overnight musical sensation in the Arab world. His name is Mohammed Asaf, and his powerful singing voice has been dominating the hit Friday evening television program Arab Idol.
Although Mohammed nearly missed his own audition, his performances are now engendering an unlikely spirit of reconciliation between Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Joseph Dana finds out more for this week's edition of Culture.
For the past several weeks, downtown Ramallah has transformed from a bustling city center to a musical carnival on Friday evenings. Plastic chairs line the city streets as every vendor in town rushes to offer their selection of grilled meats and falafel sandwiches to the eager crowds. Entire families mill about, waiting for 9 o'clock to roll around and for Palestinian singing sensation Mohammed Asaf to take to the stage on Arab Idol, broadcast from Beirut. For Rami, a local shopkeeper, Mohammed Asaf's popularity is not just about his musical talent. He is helping to mend internal Palestinian divisions.
He is one of the most popular singers nowadays, you know. Their feeling or their perception about him that he is one of the most amazing singers, you know, in Palestine and in the whole of the Arabic world. We can say that the main point here in Palestine, and we can, as I told you, and in the whole of the Arabic world, is Mohammed Asaf. He's like one of the last hopes, you know, that maybe he will be the main bridge, you know, like for connecting the main two parts of Palestine, West Bank and Gaza.
Mohammed Asaf barely looks his 23 years. He is one of seven children from Khan Yunis in the Gaza Strip. With a contagious smile he can barely contain on stage, Asaf has wooed Arab Idol with passionate renditions of classic Arabic songs, all the while draped in a traditional Palestinian keffiyeh. Dalia Hatouka is a Palestinian journalist based in Ramallah. I asked her why his stardom has taken Palestine by storm.
If anything, it just speaks to the fact that Palestinians are really angry, they're frustrated, they feel like there's not much hope out there. And in a sense, this young man just came out of nowhere. He just burst into the limelight. He basically unified everybody across like political, economic, cultural spectrums. And he's managed to unify all these Palestinians because he represents something that's unattainable, which is somebody to believe in.
As a man under the age of 40, Asaf must coordinate his travel with Egyptian authorities in order to leave Gaza. The process almost cost him a spot in Arab Idol. Due to border troubles, Asaf arrived at the Cairo Hotel, where the auditions were being held, as the judges were already packing up. After being informed that all contestant slots had already been filled, the exhausted Asaf promptly burst into song and convinced the judges to give him a shot. Gaza and the West Bank have been physically severed since militant Islamic group Hamas took over the Gaza Strip in 2006. Restrictions on movement for Palestinians traveling between the two territories have further entrenched political divisions. Asaf's universal embrace by Palestinians has also helped connect Palestinians with the rest of the Arab world. Dalia Hatouka, again.
For the Arabs, Mohammed Asaf represents as close as they can get to Palestine. He's there, he's firing them up with all these songs about Jerusalem, about refugees, about this, about that, and all these things. I mean, these things unify Arabs. It's hard for you to even meet an average Palestinian in Lebanon from Palestine itself, because a Palestinian from the Gaza Strip or the West Bank has a huge difficulty in coming to Beirut, let alone being there with so many Arabs from places like Syria, Morocco, Egypt, Iraq, Saudi. For them, he's that person that they've always heard about, but he's there, like physically, and they can they can relate to him because they've been reading and hearing about him their whole lives.
From Fayrouz in Lebanon to Umm Kulthum in Egypt, powerful, often female singers have come to define modern Arab music. Their songs, sometimes laced with nationalist overtones, are permanent features of cafes and cabs from Tunis to Baghdad. The last 10 years has seen an explosion of satellite channels, which have broken down national boundaries across the Arab world. Almost impossibly, these two factors have collided with the successful import of American Idol to the Arab world. The show has come to typify Friday nights. Mohammed Asaf's popularity in the program are leading people like Ali, a Ramallah shopkeeper, to see the beginnings of a cultural revolution. Mohammed Asaf came out of the ruins in Gaza, Ali says. A very modest background, but it represents all Palestinians. As Yasser Arafat said, revolutions do not come with weapons, they also come from the culture. Many people you speak with in Palestine these days say that Mohammed Asaf is more popular than any political leader. It is a lot of responsibility for this young man from Gaza, but he appears to be handling it well, never letting that smile leave his lips. Whether or not Asaf is crowned the next Arab Idol on the 21st of June seems like an afterthought for many here. And for the time being, Friday nights in Palestine are welcome spaces of festive Palestinian artistic expression and unity that extends beyond politics. For Monocle, in Ramallah, I'm Joseph Dana.
And you can hear more music and arts from around the world if you tune into this week's edition of Culture with Robert Bound. That's tonight at 1900 London time.
Meanwhile, it's 8:40 in the morning here in London. You're listening to Midori House, and we'll be back right after this with a look at the North American front pages with our DC correspondent, Sasha Eisenberg.
Switzerland is the natural home of timekeeping and host to Baselworld, the most important international platform for the business of watchmaking. Monocle dispatched a film crew to investigate this year's innovation.
Baselworld attracts everybody from every tiny niche of the watch industry as a whole, and that can be somebody who buys components, somebody who sells completed watches, somebody who sells watch cases, somebody who writes about watches, and you can't really miss it.
Horological showmanship at the Basel Fairground. Check out our film on monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House, the time 8:41 here in London, a painfully early 3:41 in Washington, D.C. It's time for a look now at what's making the news stateside, but we have our Washington correspondent, Sasha Eisenberg, here with us in the studio. Welcome, Sasha.
Thanks for having me and for not making me get up at 3:41 local time.
It's a lie-in for you. What would you like to start with today? You've got two big stories for us.
Well, there's some fun news out of New York that Mayor Bloomberg's latest venture on making us all live better is a grand citywide composting program. The City Hall just sort of leaked to the New York Times that they plan this week to announce plans to develop a new compost plant and try to move 10% of the city's food waste into that type of reuse. And in classic Bloomberg fashion, there's a quote from a City Hall official who says that eventually it'll be mandatory.
Of course, like he's tried to curb soda consumption, ban smoking. When I first moved to New York about 4 years ago, I was staggered by how little recycling facilities there were. Like, coming from London, it just seemed extraordinarily difficult to recycle. Has New York caught up, do you think? Is it likely that the composting faculties are going to be easy for the average household to just get behind?
I mean, one of the big advances we've seen in a lot of American cities in the last few years in terms of recycling, not for food, but for packaging materials and stuff, has been the single stream recycling where you throw everything, your plastics, your paper, your cardboard, your metal in one bin, and then there's technology that sorts it at the plant. And actually, it's sort of a win-win. It's a lot less work, obviously, for consumers. You don't have to do this sort of rigorous sorting. That was always the problem, I think, in the U.S. in the 80s and 90s. You had to have three bins and all these instructions about what went into each of them. It also makes it more lucrative on the other end because they can resell, you know, plastics or metals by the pound or ton because they've been cleanly sorted. So that, I believe, has increased in a lot of places, recycling rates, because it basically took the work out of it. You know, food waste is a bit messier.
Let's just put this into context for our listeners. I mean, this piece in the New York Times says that the Bloomberg's administration plans to announce these plans that will handle 1,000 tons of food scraps a year.
100,000.
100,000 tons. Thank you. Come and see. Of food scraps a year, which is 10% of the city's residential food waste. I mean, that's a massive program to start on a voluntary basis when you're leaving office shortly. What's the likelihood this program will continue if he doesn't, you know, find a successor who's on board?
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine. Well, we'll see this week. There's a fairly dynamic Democratic primary for mayor in which every candidate wants to find some way to define themselves against Bloomberg. I'm not sure this is going to be the media's target, but I'm sure somebody, this will actually be a test of sort of the Democrats in this field as to how far they'll try to go to find a way at going at Bloomberg. You know, there's sort of a pushback on the City Bikes program. There's a whole sort of sense of like Bloomberg's sort of lifestyle gentrification initiatives being designed for, sort of the wealthy in Manhattan. And so I do wonder whether part of this will be a sort of class-based outer borough sense that,
I mean, for a start, kitchens in New York are famously, legendarily tiny. And we're talking about food scraps, chicken bones, stale bread, potato peels sitting in this container in their kitchen. Now, you know, most people in New York have a kitchen that's the size of, you know, this table, if not smaller.
And the rats are larger than this table.
And the rats and the roaches and all of the other. Exactly. So do you think most New Yorkers will have a problem with that? As you say, if it's fine for the wealthy Park Avenue princesses with their enormous kitchens. But for the most part, even people living in relatively big apartments have these tiny, tiny kitchens.
Yeah, I mean, that would be my instinct. I mean, one of the things that's sort of been telling about the Bloomberg administration is you get, you know, going back to the smoking ban almost 10 years ago, is you do have all of these claims that things are going to disrupt some way of life. And people adjust actually pretty quickly. And, you know, the resentment and pushback subside pretty quickly. So I suppose
if they make the savings they're hoping to make as well, that will help the program settle in. It was like $100 million. Dollars a year by diverting this food away from the landfills.
Yeah, there's a sense that it's an economically productive thing for the city. And, you know, there definitely is a new sense of sort of environmental awareness and of sort of, you know, responsible food culture. So I could imagine there people would be interested in trying to be part of it.
Let's move over to the Supreme Court and gay marriage rulings, a range of possible Supreme Court rulings that we might see at the end of this month. Tell us more.
Yeah, so as early as today, and if not, then Thursday or next Monday. I mean, each of these days, the Supreme Court at the end of their term presents opinions. We don't know which ones come down which days, but there are a few really important long-awaited ones, including on these two gay marriage cases that were heard at the same time. And so we could know as early as mid-morning Washington time that the Supreme Court has ruled. There are sort of two issues up. There's the Defense of Marriage Act, which was the federal law that was passed by Congress in 1996 and signed by President Clinton, that in this case says that the federal government will not recognize marriages even if they've been legally recognized in what is now 12 states. Everybody expects that is very likely to be struck down, which would mean that federal benefits for gay couples, military benefits, Social Security benefits would flow. The more complicated thing is this California case, which has the widest range of possible outcomes, but people think is most likely to be determined on sort of some procedural technicalities that will have could very quickly reinstate legal gay marriage in California, but not have any impact anywhere else.
Poppy, you go ahead.
Well, do you think that after having been through this in California once and have it removed and bring it back, it's gaining momentum and it's becoming a more solid proposition, or do you think it's just still that volatile an issue that it could be removed?
We've seen the
back
poll
to square one.
Yeah, I mean, so this case grows out of this 2008 vote on Proposition 8 that failed by several points at a time when Obama was on the ballot, so it was a fairly liberal electorate. We've seen the polling move in California something like 10 points just in those 5 years. And by all accounts, if it were on the ballot now, it would pass by over 10 points.
I'm just curious, does divorce factor into this in any way?
Yeah, this is actually sort of the legally the most fascinating problem is that you can sort of see a state, you know, we have a state-by-state marriage thing. You could see a framework where people can get married in one state. The problem is, once you move, how you get divorced in a state that never thought you were married in the first place.
Yeah, and I like the fact that this San Francisco attorney has jokingly referred to this marriage as wedlocked.
Yes.
Which is great. You might have to move back to that state, and then, you know, it will have quite wide-ranging social implications, I feel.
It'll be whatever the reverse of a honeymoon is for a divorcing couple to have to travel back across the country.
I can see the Hollywood movies loving this, jumping on this idea that they have to move back together.
Sasha Eisenberg, great to have you in the studio with us for a change. Many thanks.
Thank you.
A roundup of the Middle East front pages in just a moment, but first a song. This is Lebanese Blonde by Thievery Corporation. That was Thievery Corporation there. It's time now for a roundup of today's Middle East press. And for this job, we are joined in the studio again by Monocle's Jerusalem correspondent, Joseph Dana. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's very nice to have you, all of our correspondents, actually in the studio, I must say. I mean, not that it's not great to talk to you over the air, but it's lovely to have you all in-house. Let's start with Israel, shall we? A story that you found in the Jerusalem Post.
Right. Well, the Israeli press is understandably awash in some conversation about what's gone on in Iran over the weekend. And it's quite interesting. You know, the Israeli press has been a bit, let's say, schizophrenic on some of the most important issues facing Israel, mostly
one
Syria.
One way of putting it, Joseph.
It's a nice way of putting it. And so, again, we see this trend, you know, it happens a lot in Syria as to what Israel's, you know, plan is with the Syrian situation. And now we have it with Iran. And so we have the cover of the Jerusalem Post carrying the headline of the prime minister saying we won't be deluded with wishful thinking about Iran. And so, you know, over the last, let's say, 6 years at least, the Israelis have made a very strong push in the international community to drum up a lot of support for aggressive military actions and sanctions and whatnot in Iran. And now we have this kind of reformist, let's say, candidate coming to the forefront, winning now the president-elect, and how the Israelis are going to be able to articulate their position on the Iranian regime is up in question.
Well, Netanyahu said Iran will be judged by its actions, namely stopping the nuclear program. He made it unequivocally clear what they want to hear from them first. But the rest of the world wants to hear a variety of things from Iran. Do you think that they'll deal with this issue first?
Well, we'll see. I think that Iran has become a very important part of the Israeli understanding of the Middle East in terms of its ability to have this external threat that is always present. And so if there's an internal issue in Israel, whether it be African refugees in Tel Aviv or the Palestinian-Israeli conflict or even Syria, the Israelis can always drum up that external support, especially in the United States. I can say from my own experience, I live in Israel now, Israel-Palestine for 7 years, and my mother, God bless her, always says, you know, whenever the Iranian thing comes up, she's always like, you have to get out of there because I'm going to drop bombs and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And so now that we have this new candidate that might not be willing to engage in such vociferous rhetoric about the Israeli state, that could throw a wrench in terms of their kind of outward propaganda schedule and whatnot.
Interesting to see how it develops. Let's move over to Jordan. Ratcheting up the pressure on Assad in Syria. The U.S. is saying that they'll keep American warplanes and anti-missile batteries in Jordan.
Right. Now, this is it's an expected story. There's some very large military exercises going on in Jordan. And so the Americans, with the help of the Israelis and others, have taken the opportunity to move in some quite heavy military equipment. And so I think that we're going to see more of this kind of movement in the coming months, in which the Jordanian and the Turkish air defenses are kind of shored up as Syria takes yet another turn, probably for the worst. Now, it's quite interesting to look at these periphery countries because, you know, moving from Jordan, we have in the same article some conversation about what President Mohamed Morsi in Cairo is doing with the Syrians. It turns out that he is interested in severing diplomatic ties with Syria and closing the embassy in Cairo and withdrawing the Egyptian envoy from Damascus. And so this is also a hot topic in Egyptian society. Mm. The opposition has claimed that he's doing this, Morsi's doing this at the behest of the United States. And I think that what we're seeing just in this kind of small article in the IHT is that reconstellation of the forces in at least the American allies in the Middle East as Syria kind of moves into this next category and arms will likely start flowing.
And America's following America's decision, of course, or at least commitment to arm the rebels. This comes at the request of Jordan. Does it really?
Well,
purely,
or
is it
the
U.S.? I mean, come follow so quickly on from that announcement in the U.S. that they would arm the rebels. I just wonder how well timed this all was.
Well, it's definitely well timed, and that's clearly by design. But the Jordanians have their own issues. Last week, we were talking about the new law that is banning upwards of 300 news websites in Jordan. And so Jordan, you know, this has been the question mark in the last 2 years, in the years of Arab revolution, is whether or not Jordan will fall. And so this example that the United States is going to very much shore up the military defenses shows that the United States does not want Jordan to change or kind of get swept up in this Arab revolutions. And they're willing to, you know, kind of put their muscle in the country physically to make sure that doesn't happen.
Let's shift our focus quickly while we have time over to Egypt and what New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman is calling its perilous drift.
Right. Well, I think that Egypt is the kind of sleeper country right now in this very turbulent Middle Eastern picture. Let's say if we include Turkey in this, we have lots of protests going on. We have the Americans presumably sending weapons to the rebels. We have the Israelis and the Palestinians bickering as they always do. And then we have Egypt, which has been somewhat quiet. But the opposition has raised something like 13 million signatures against the rule of Morsi. And we're coming up to the anniversary, the first year anniversary of Morsi's election on June 30th. And so if Thomas Friedman is writing in the IHT saying that Egypt needs a new revolution and it's coming, it's a foregone conclusion. I mean, no offense to Thomas Friedman, but, you know, if the cab drivers are telling him that in Cairo, it's clearly there. And so I think that this is interesting that this is something we have to kind of expect around the 30th, that Egypt is going to clog our headlines and we're going to be talking a lot about where that country is going.
And certainly over the weekend, things really galvanized everyone's focus there on how quickly it might escalate. Thank you so much for joining us, Joseph Dana there, Monocle's Jerusalem correspondent, in the studio with us for a change. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producers, Barbara Feeney and Annabelle Blythe, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Up next after the news is this week's edition of The Urbanist, presented by Andrew Tuck.
And the briefing with Marcus Hippie will be on at midday in London time. But from me, Clemency Burton-Hill.
And me, Poppy Trowbridge.
Thanks for listening.
Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.